A Brawl from a suite of pieces for the Musette by the 18th century French composer Jean Hotteterre. It's from a new album called Music for French Kings, put together and performed by Amanda Babington, who's my guest in the studio today. Amanda, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, over the next hour, we're going to be finding out all about the Musette and its history and, of course, hearing it played. And in case you're wondering, yes, there is an absolute wealth of music written specially for it. But I guess I better start with the obvious first question. Amanda, what exactly is a Musette? I've heard the word used to describe a dance and sometimes even an accordion. But what sort of instrument are we going to be hearing today?
Well, the musette is a very delicate type of bagpipe. It's a smallish instrument, quite unlike the ones that most people will be familiar with, the Highland bagpipes. And it's one of the bellows-blown family of bagpipes rather than the mouth-blown pipes that you'll often hear.
And it had a rustic sort of beginnings, didn't it?
Yes, that's right. So in common with most bagpipes, actually, its origins lie in the pastoral settings. It would have been played by shepherds in the fields attending their sheep.
But they've made their own bagpipes, do you think? Because it's actually a bladder.
Absolutely, yes. So they're still made from animal hide today. And they follow the same form as they would have in the 18th century and 17th century and earlier. So on one side you have the bladder or the sac, and on the other side you have the bellows, which provide the air.
So we're thinking communal music making on the village green somewhere in rural France. But then what's so interesting is that it sort of made its way, the musette, eventually into the more refined world of art music, so to speak. Do we know when that change began to happen?
Well, it's first mentioned in a 1637 book called Harmonie Universelle by Marin Mersenne. And then we see it mentioned in a court circular called L'État de la France in 1661, where it's one of the instruments of the écurie or stable. These are, however, possibly mouth-blown musette de Poitou, which is a slightly different instrument. However, we know from two treatises that were published almost exactly the period of the musette's heyday. The last one was by Hotteterre, Jacques Lemartin Hotteterre, and this was published in 1737, right towards the end of its popularity. But the first one was published in 1672 by Pierre Bourgeon de Sellery.
And I think we're going to hear a piece by him next. Is this another dance?
Yes, that's right. It's another bronze. And these feature at the end of his treatise as pieces for players to practice, to learn the instrument.
Thank you.
to Rustic Brawls by Pierre Bourgeon de Sellery. That one was played on the Musette by Jean-Christophe Maillard. And the first was played by my studio guest today, Amanda Babington. Amanda, you say the Musette climbed up the social ladder from the rustic village green to the fashionable Parisian scene. But how did that transition, that elevation, come about?
Well, it was really thanks to Louis XIV. He had a passion for pastoral soirees at which he would adopt the rustic dress of a peasant, which was still made of silk, of course, but slightly shorter in the hem. And these soirees would consist of dance and music, occasionally even bringing sheep into the Palace of Versailles, which must have been interesting. And it was here that the Musette really featured as a pastoral instrument, so part of this theme, really. And it's rumoured, although not proven, that Louis XIV himself played the instrument. And it's really thanks to his patronage that we see composers begin to write for it, members of the aristocracy start to learn it, and thus it becomes embedded as part of this high art scene.
Because we know Louis XIV had lots of professional musicians in the royal household whose job it was to play for the various different occasions as the mood took the king or the court. They played everything from opera and recitals to very intimate private music in the king's chamber. I'm just trying to think where the Musette might have come into all that.
It's very interesting. We see it moving around a bit as if no one's quite sure where its natural home is. So we see it in the outdoor instruments, the instruments of the écurie, the stables. But we also see music for it in the instruments du chambre, so the most intimate music settings. And it tends to be played by musicians who play other instruments, so particularly oboists and some flautists. We tend to see lots of different music written for it, really across the board at Versailles.
What about the big name composers at Versailles, Lully, de Lalande, Charpentier and all the rest? Did they write music specially for the Musette, or was it just something you could play on the Musette if you happened to have one around?
Well, it's very interesting. There's a mixture of the two. So lots of composers, including these big names, wrote maybe one or two pieces specifically for the Musette. But then we see in manuscripts, it's added to the dessous or the top melody line of lots of other music. Lully adopted it very much. It was part of his orchestra by 1672, and he included the Musette specifically in three of his operas, Les Plaisirs de l'Île Enchantée, Thésée, and Les Fêtes de la Mort de Bacchus. And here we see it actually added in, often by hand, to the scores, so that it was used as a sort of extra colour at times.
Such an atmospheric sound, it immediately seems to take you to the countryside. So what have you chosen for us to hear next?
We're going to hear two extracts from Lully's Les Fêtes de l'Amour et de Bacchus, the Symphonie pour les hautbois et de Musette, and the Rondo from Act 3.
Oh,
two excerpts from a pastoral by Lully called Les Fêtes de l'Amour et de Bacchus, something to do with love and drink, I think, staged in 1672 at the Palace of Versailles to entertain King Louis XIV. Amanda, now, as I said, that piece is described as a pastoral. What exactly did that word mean at the time? Did it mean it was an opera, or perhaps it was just a play with incidental music?
These pastorals are sort of set pieces in terms of the narrative. They're always about love, usually unrequited, and then resolved between shepherds and shepherdesses. And they have allegorical figures that introduce the different emotions that the audience should be feeling. They're really neither an opera nor a play, but they incorporated elements of dance and singing.
What about the next generation of royals? Because Louis XIV died in 1715 and he was succeeded by his great-grandson Louis XV, although he was only 5 years old when he took the throne. I'm just wondering whether the Musette continued to play a part in court musical activities under the new king.
We're fortunate because by the time of Louis XV's accession, the Musette is really embedded in musical life at court. We have two dynasties, two musical families who are very much part of musical life at court, the Hotteterres and the Chédivilles. And we see lots of collections of pieces that reflect how the Musette was used at court. So we see lots of dance music and reflections on daily life, such as music for going to sleep or waking up. And it's well known outside of court too. We see it in operas by Comprar and Montclair around this time. And then we're moving towards a period of booming published works for Musette, many of which are aimed at the growing amateur market. And so we see composers such as Boismortier and Nodot really taking advantage of this from the 1720s onward.
We're going to hear a Musette in a solo cantata now, which is a bit different. What are we going to hear and what's it about?
We're going to hear La Naissance de la Musette by a composer who wrote an enormous amount for the Musette, Michel Corrette. He wrote one of the earliest cello treatises, so it's a surprise to see him as a Musette composer. His works were really almost exclusively aimed at the amateur market, and we know this because of their simplicity. He uses the simplest part of the instrument in terms of range, but he obviously got to know the instrument incredibly well through his composing.
What's the cantata about? Is it the usual love story, unrequited love?
Yes, in a nutshell. But it's also, it sort of celebrates in an allegorical way the instrument and what it represents in terms of its pastoral past, really, and what its sound world evokes too.
Thank you. Ensemble Les Fêtes Galantes with that cantata by Michel Courette called The Birth of the Musette. Amanda Babington, I guess as a musette player these days, you're perhaps still something of a rarity. How were you first introduced to the instrument and indeed why did you decide to play it?
That's a very good question. We are indeed a rarity. There's only really a handful of players across the world, really. For me, it was a hobby that got out of hand, essentially. I thought I'd take up bagpipes as a hobby, and rather than taking up something that I could learn at home in the comfort of my own home, or at least my own city, if not my own country, I fell in love with these particular pipes, partly because I love French Baroque music, and so I ended up studying it first in Toulouse and then in Belgium, where I ended up doing a master's in performance in it.
Now, Amanda, you've actually brought an instrument in. It's a really charming looking little, to me it looks like a miniature bagpipe. Perhaps you can talk us through it and how it sounds and indeed how it all works.
Yes, so I mentioned already that it's bellows blown rather than mouth blown. And this was perhaps why we know that ladies also played it. It wasn't just an instrument confined to men. So on the right-hand side, you have the bellows, which are worked by your right arm. And on the left-hand side, there is the sack, the air sack, which your left arm works. And then they're joined by a pipe or tube through which the air passes. This instrument has two chalumeaux or chanters. Early instruments only had a single chanter, and the small chanter, the petit chalumeau, was added much later. Inside each of the chanters or chalumeaux, there's a double reed, which looks almost exactly like an oboe reed. And then the sort of most stunning feature of each chalumeau, really, is the combination of holes and keys that go all the way round, well, three sides of each of the chalumeaux. This means that all of the fingers on each hand, including the right-hand thumb, are required to play the different combinations of keys and holes that you need. And then in the middle, protruding from the sack in a small drone shuttle, are the drones. And these are operated with a system of sliding pieces that open and shut them, and that's how you tune them. And then the sound is made by the air blowing across yet more double reeds, which are inside the drone shuttle. Some instruments have only two or three drones, but they can have up to six drones in the later models.
And what's so wonderful, it's incredibly portable because it's basically strapped around your waist, isn't it? I mean, I could easily see you performing for dance music, being able to walk around the room perhaps to play to different people. It's so portable.
Yes, absolutely. And we know from iconography that players would play it in all sorts of locations, giving the impression that actually it was considered a portable instrument.
Well, let's give us a little demonstration. Well, that was a lovely sound. What's so interesting is that you're doing lots of things at once. I mean, I know playing a musical instrument always involves a bit of that, but your arm's going up and down for the bellows and you're holding on to the bag, and at the same time you're playing some really intricate music. It's delightful. I feel like taking it up immediately myself. What about the dynamic range, though? Because it seemed quite loud here in the studio. And of course, if you were playing with an orchestra, you'd have to be loud enough to be heard. But you'd also have to be quiet enough to play as part of a chamber ensemble.
It's very interesting. There's something very curious about the tone of the instrument, which means that in an orchestral setting, it penetrates the texture really quite well. Under your ear, it sounds very loud, and yet doing chamber music in often an intimate setting, it actually blends and balances very well with the other instruments. And if you stand a foot away when you're playing chamber music, actually can't hear it very loudly at all. So it's a strange sort of chameleon instrument.
Thank you. Dances from a suite of pieces by Colin Charpentier, played there by Amanda Babington on the musette and Claire Babington on the cello, who I imagine is a relation.
That's right, my sister.
Very good. Cello and musette, who knew? You're listening to The Early Music Show on BBC Radio 3 with me, Lucy Skeeping, and today I'm with Amanda Babington, exploring the rather extraordinary history and sound world of a bagpipe instrument called the musette, which became very popular in France at the turn of the 18th century. So we've heard the musette in operas by Lully and Rameau, and in that gorgeous cantata by Corrette, and also just now as a duet. What about as a solo instrument, though, Amanda? Were composers actively writing, say, a sonata or a little dance suite for the musette player simply to play on its own?
Absolutely. It's very interesting to see how composers wrote really for all of the different genres, as if they were experimenting with how the musette might fit into the different combinations of instruments. So we see a lot of duos for two musettes or for musette and another melody instrument, and then occasionally, as we heard there, for bass. We see lots of dance suites, which really reflects the integration of the musette into daily life in France. We see lots of the traditional French dance suites. And then we also see the emergence of the Italian influence that was really sweeping France from about the 1730s onwards. And that's when we start to see the Italianate form of sonatas that feature the instrument.
You've chosen a sonata by a composer called Nicolas Chedevi to hear next. What do we know about him? Was he a court musician?
He was. He was one of the two dynasties of musette makers and players. He and his brother Esprit Philippe were related to the Hotteterres, about whom we've already talked. In fact, his great uncle was Louis Hotteterre, and it's thought that Nicolas might have learned instrument making from him. He was called by a contemporary the most celebrated musette player France had ever had, and he was very successful. He taught Louis XV's daughter, Princess Victoire, how to play, and he earned good money teaching amongst the aristocracy too. It's therefore quite interesting to note that he evidently felt that he needed an extra edge to be successful, because in 1737 he made a secret agreement with a publisher to pass off a collection of his own compositions as being by Vivaldi, perhaps to give the musette the endorsement that Vivaldi's name would give it. This backfired later, and it was discovered that actually they were by Chedevi, and in fact they didn't sell very well anyway, for reasons unknown. Thank you.
Sonata by the 18th century French composer and musette player Nicolas Chedeville. It was played there by Jean-Christophe Maillard with the ensemble Les Plaisirs Champêtres. I guess the musette is an instrument that allowed the super rich royals to imagine they were happy peasants. Is that an accurate way of describing its kind of social purpose?
Yes, I think it is. And then it evolved from there into being really an instrument that lay at the heart of music making and enjoyment of oneself.
And you mentioned that interest in the musette nevertheless evaporated from around the 1750s at the French court. Do we know why?
Yes, I think there are three main reasons. The first being that the market had really been saturated by an enormous number of compositions in the preceding decades, and so perhaps interest started to naturally die off. Then there was also a development in 1768, which was claimed by the maker Luzzi, in which it was possible then to shut off the continuous sound made by the drones and indeed by the Grand Chalumeau, which I guess once you had that, you lost some of the instrument's unique sound. But I think what really finished it was France's progression towards the revolution and the instrument's indelible links to the aristocracy and royalty, of course, I think was what really finished it.
So when was it actually rediscovered? Was it presumably part of the early music revival, that incredibly important time around the 1950s, 60s?
Yes, in part. In fact, there was an early failed attempt by Eugène de Bricqueville in 1894. And then there was a sort of fallow period, and it's a bit of a latecomer to the early music revival. It wasn't really until the 1970s that we start to see players like Shelley Gruskin, Jean-Christophe Maillard and various other names applying themselves to the rediscovery of the instrument, how it sounded and crucially how it was made as well.
What about today's musette players or up-and-coming musette players? I imagine they might well come from a conventional woodwind background, like perhaps being oboists, as they were in the 18th century, who took up the instrument. Or do some of them come originally as from the traditional bagpipe world, the Scottish bagpipe world, perhaps?
Absolutely, yes. Really, the vast majority come from the traditional bagpiping world, which is something that took me by surprise. I mean, my own background is very much in the classical music world, but there's only really perhaps two others who have approached it from that end. So we see musette players today generally starting with the bagpipe from their own locality, and then they move on to the musette.
What about the folk world and the Northumbrian pipes, which have become so fashionable in the last, I don't know, 20, 30 years?
Yes, they're very close connections. And in fact, Northumbrian pipes are really the closest living relative to the musette. So they have that shared sort of history.
What about the repertoire that people are generally playing these days? Is it mainly the French Baroque? I guess that's where the focus lies.
I think it is now, but really, actually, there's been a strong tradition of playing folk music on musette, and I guess this is because a lot of the players come from the bagpiping world, and so they tend to play the music they know on the musette and then move towards the musette's own traditional repertoire.
Joseph et bien marié, a Noël or Christmas song by Marc-Antoine Charpentier, performed there by Les Musiciens de Saint-Julien, directed by François Lazarevitch. We'll be back with more from Amanda and the Musette shortly. But first, here's a roundup of this week's early music news.
Coming up today, the influence of Chinese music in the 18th century. But first, a musical mashup of dog barks, horses' hooves, and tally-hoes. The Brecon Baroque Festival begins this Friday, 21st of October, featuring concerts, workshops, walks, and talks, with the music of Johann Sebastian Bach forming the heart of the festival. But alongside the sublime, there's also the ridiculous. That's the title of Saturday's lunchtime concert in Brecon Cathedral. Directed by Robert Hollingworth, the vocal ensemble I Fagiolini will sing music by Monteverdi and Purcell. There's also Clément Yannican's sound effects jamboree, La Chasse, composed in 1537. Robert Hollingworth tells us more.
Clément Yannican tells the story of a hunt for a stag, in which all these different things go on at the same time. And in it, you have these written out sound effects, the barking dogs, horses, hooves, screams of the hunters. It's just a complete sort of mix of noise and madness. Apparently simple, but actually quite difficult to sing. I keep bringing it out every few years because it's such fun to do and such a good piece, such a visual piece for audience as well.
That was Robert Hollingworth ahead of I Fagiolini's concert this Saturday as part of the Brecon Baroque Festival. Could it get more French than Jean-Philippe Rameau? Well, the latest research from Yale University offers a fresh perspective. The musicologist Qingfang Jiang argues that Western music was in fact shaped by knowledge from the East, with Rameau particularly interested in Chinese music. Here's Qingfang Jiang.
Based on his study of Chinese music, he argued that harmony as opposed to melody was a foundation of music. Because people who have a long history, the Egyptians and the Chinese, they derived their musical scales from harmony. In Rameau's case, Chinese music played a major role in shaping his theoretical ideas.
Musicologist Qingfang Jiang of Yale's Institute of Sacred Music. Now for some early music highlights coming up this week here on Radio 3. This evening, the listening service unlocks the mysteries of Bach's towering Goldberg variations. You can hear music by Jean-Baptiste Lully, Marie Marais, François Couperin and Antoine Fouqueray, all masters of the French Baroque, from the Spretzingen Festival in Germany across the week in afternoon concert. And on Saturday, percussionist Callum Huggan creates a playlist for Inside Music that includes a melody by John Dowland reworked for the marimba. And that's this week's Early Music News with me, Mark Xiao.
And there'll be more early music news for you next week. Amanda, is research into the history and technique of the musette still going on these days? I mean, I imagine there's still quite a bit to discover.
Indeed, yes. There's been a lot of research into the organology of the instrument, so makers have studied the existing models. But actually, there's still so much to be done around the history and the context and the repertoire. Very little is known of many of the composers for the instrument, really surprisingly so, and some of the players too. So Colin Charpentier, that we heard a piece by earlier, was a virtuoso player, famous in his own time, but we don't even know his dates of birth and death now. And then there is the peripheral research, for example, other players of the instrument, people like Charles Edward Stuart, otherwise known as Bonnie Prince Charlie, apparently owned two musettes, but little is known about what he played on them.
Well, thanks so much for being my guest today, Amanda. It's really been interesting, very interesting journey through the sound world of the musette, I must say. I think we should close the programme with a little more from your new album. This is music by the virtuoso musette player we talked about earlier, Nicolas Chédeville, who was active during the first quarter of the 18th century. What can you tell us about this suite?
Well, first of all, this time he published it under his own name, and it's in the form of a traditional French dance suite. But not every movement is in fact a dance. In fact, they form a series of sort of miniature tableaux, each one described a character or a scene or emotion. It was published between 1739 and 50, and I think the title really tells you a lot about what Chédiville intended it for. It's called The Challenges, or The Study of Fun. Most of the pieces are dedicated to patrons or potential patrons, and so it seems that these were really intended for perhaps his students to play, but essentially for people to enjoy.